This is a download from the Post-Keynesian Economic Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
Good evening and welcome to the Keynes Seminar at Robinson College. It's nice to see a few new faces here. My name is Mark Hayes. I'm the secretary of the Post-Keynesian Economic Study Group and the organiser of this seminar. And tonight our principal speaker is Eric Baer, who is Associate Professor at the University of Bordeaux and a visiting scholar with the Committee for Development Studies here at Cambridge for the current academic year. His research interests are sustainable development, development financing, and post-Keynesian economics. So we'll hear about at least two of his core areas of interest tonight. And after Eric has given his presentation, our lead discussant is Adrian Winnett. Is it Winnett or Winnett?
Winnett.
Who is a senior lecturer in economics at the University of Bath and sometime secretary of PKSG, I believe.
Yes.
A long time ago, I think. He initially specialised in monetary economics and in growth and capital theory, but he's increasingly shifted into environmental and natural resource economics while retaining a macro emphasis on sustainability. So he's an environmental economist who understands macroeconomics. So we look forward to his contribution. So without further ado, over to you, Eric.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. Thank you for the invitation. Thank you all for coming. The topic of my presentation is, as you can see, about Keynes, the post-Keynesian, and sustainable development. Of course, Keynes was not aware about sustainability issues, but we'll try to find some insights in his work. I would say to begin with that nowadays, sustainable development is a notion that guides many economic policies in both the developed and the developing world, and offers a roadmap for a number of international institutions. At the same time, it is precisely because of this ostensible unanimity that the concept's exact meaning should be specified to keep it from turning into yet another empty vessel. If the concept of sustainable development has been popularized in the 1980s, there has been a growing concern and growing interest in environmental issues since the late 1960s. An early example was work done by the Club of Rome, whose Meadows report was published in 1972. This text highlighted the ecological consequences of the Western model of development and demonstrated for the first time that there are natural limitations to economic growth. That very same year, the first United Nations Conference on Environment and Development took place in Stockholm and definitively established the environment as an agenda item for the international community. This conference offered the world's developing countries an argument for exploring other modes of growth and ultimately gave birth to the construct of eco-development, which highlights principles like fairness, the minimization of damage to natural systems, respect for different cultures and socio-economic planning. The 1974 Cocoyoc Declaration, which followed a seminar which took place in this town in Mexico, this Cocoyoc Declaration announced awareness of how difficult it will be over the long run to satisfy human needs in a distressed and natural environment. By strengthening the concept of eco-development, it called for more radical solutions. It is worth noting that eco-development has been theorized by Ignacy Sachs, who once a close colleague of Kalitsky at the Warsaw School of Planning and Statistics.
And no relation to Jeffrey.
And no relation at all to Jeffrey. He was a close colleague to Kalitsky in Warsaw in the 1960s. and Sachs recognizes his Kaletskian affiliation. Sachs's starting point is to denounce the wrong development of the so-called developed countries and the consequences for the rest of the world due to their domination, the existence of knock-on effects, and a tendency to imitate this model. This wrong development is wasteful on two levels, both relating to a poor distribution of wealth. On one hand, the rich overconsume and thereby use up most of the world's available resources. On the other hand, the poor underconsume and are forced by their own misery to overuse the few resources they can access. The battle against waste, therefore, appears to be indissociable from the fight against misery and the wrong management of the environment. In short, eco-development relies on three pillars. The first one is self-reliance, which encourages autonomous decisions and the emergence of modes of alternative development, encompassing the historical, cultural, and ecological context that are specific to each country. Secondly, a fair assessment of everyone's essential material and immaterial needs, especially people's need to realize themselves through a meaningful life. And finally, ecological prudence, or the search for a kind of development that is in harmony with nature. Because of its call for more radical solutions, eco-development has been progressively marginalized by the United Nations and replaced by the concept of sustainable development. However, behind the official definition given by the Brundtland Report, that is to say, sustainable development seeks to meet the needs and aspirations of the present without compromising the ability to meet those of the future, two antagonistic conceptions of sustainability appear. The first one is neoclassical in inspiration and serves as a basis for weak sustainability. It tries to give monetary value to natural elements so that they could be integrated into a cost-benefit analysis. It assumes a virtuous relationship between economic growth and environmental quality, as it is encapsulated in the environmental Kuznets curve. It also postulates perfect substitutability between the different forms of capital, whether physical, human, or natural. The second approach offers a more radical vision, founded on a strong sustainability. Here, ecological sustainability supposes to reject the principle of the substitutability of production factor to emphasize their complementarity instead. It disagrees with a monetary valuation of natural elements, and it seeks a development process that combines the satisfaction of basic needs, an acceptable level of social homogeneity, a fair distribution of incomes, and full employment. The triumph of neoliberalism over the past 30 years has imposed weak sustainability as a new worldwide objective. For developing countries, this means achieving the Millennium Development Goals while searching for a better quality of growth in developed countries. Whatever the term we use, sustainable development, eco-development, I think it is only possible to view the future optimistically if a break can be engineered with the neoliberal perspective. Indeed, obvious links can be stressed between eco-development and strong sustainability, links which should be deepened with post-Keynesian economics. Towards this end, I firstly revisit the works of Keynes in order to show that his analysis is compatible with a sustainable development-based approach, and especially with strong sustainability. Indeed, it is the case of his positions on environment and arts which lead him to a virulent criticism of capitalism. It is also the case of his philosophy of uncertainty, which foreshadows a precautionary principle. And it is the case when he emphasizes on unemployment and equity and minimizes the role of economics. Secondly, if few weaknesses can be pointed out as regards the role of economic growth or the place of effective demand in Keynes's work, I show that they can be overcome by referring to Kaletsky, thus making post-Keynesianism compatible with strong sustainability. Keynes's references to environmental issues are rather rare. This can be easily explained if one keeps in mind the historical context of the first half of the 20th century. Indeed, the main concerns are to manage the First World War consequences, to correct monetary and financial imbalances, to fight against mass unemployment, or more generally, to implement an international environment aiming at favoring peace. However, he knows that some classical economists have investigated environmental issues, such as Malthus on population or Stuart Mill in connection with a search for a steady state. However, we can find some allusions to the environment in a text entitled National Self-Sufficiency, which has been published in 1933, where Keynes militates in favor of a gradual movement of relative withdrawal of national economies in order to restore the primacy of politics on economics. As I quoted, and Keynes said, "I sympathize, therefore, with those who would minimize rather than with those who would maximize economic entanglement between nations. Ideas, knowledge, art, hospitality, travel, these are the things which should, of their nature, be international. But let goods be homespun whenever it is reasonably and conveniently possible, and, above all, let finance be primarily national." This reduction of the interdependence between nations is wished today by the advocates of a strong sustainability. Through it, we would assist to a relocalization of the production, limiting transport in the productive processes and thus various pollutions. Moreover, he condemns the financial speculation whose dramatic consequences can be seen every day, and it is particularly the case at present. He also realizes that economic and financial logic are in opposition with ecological and social reason. Another quote from Keynes, where he says that the same rule of self-destructive financial calculation governs every walk of life. We destroy the beauty of the countryside because the unappropriated splendors of nature have no economic value. We are capable of shutting off the sun and the stars because they do not pay a dividend. Of course, if direct references to environmental problems are rather limited, the stances of Keynes as regards art contain the premises of a Keynesian approach to of environment. In his opinion, art as nature must be disconnected from economic consideration. As he stated in a text on arts published in 1936, he said, "The exploitation and incidental destruction of the divine gift of the public entertainer by prostituting it to the purposes of financial gain is one of the worst crimes of present-day capitalism." Thus, his positions concerning environment and arts lead Keynes to formulate a virulent criticism of capitalism, which can be found in many texts. In his opinion, capitalism is amoral, as he said in a text published in 1925. text on Russia when he was after he married, he went to Russia and wrote three papers. And from one of these, he said, "It seems clearer every day that the moral problem of our age is concerned with the love of money, with the habitual appeal to the money motive in 9/10 of the activities of life, with the universal striving after individual economic security as a prime objective of endeavor, with the social approbation of money as a measure of constructive success. Moreover, he recognizes the confiscation of the power by a minority for its own interest. As he said, it is a modern method to depend on propaganda and to save the organs of opinion. It is thought to be clever and useful to fossilize thought and to use all the forces of authority to paralyze the play of mind on mind. On this point, the partisans of the strong sustainability fully agree with Keynes. Indeed, they consider capitalism to be responsible of the increase of inequalities, while it reinforces the power of the so-called powerful, that is to say, mainly multinational firm managers, northern but also thousand political leaders and main media. Thus, those powerful manage to convince the victims of the system how they need to make sacrifices today in order to reach an unceasingly deferred and largely illusory happiness." To sum up this point, Keynes is conscious of environmental and cultural limits of capitalism, but I think for more personal reasons, due mainly to his social origins, he rejects any idea of revolution and preaches gradual changes towards a society less subjective to international constraints. What about uncertainty and precautionary principle? If the concept of uncertainty constitutes one of the pillars of Keynes's revolution, his vision of this on this subject is strongly influenced by the philosophy of George Moore. Moore considered that we can never be sure of the results of our actions, nor even of their desirable nature. As there is no probabilistic basis, we must rely on traditions or moral standards, for instance, to take decisions. Keynes will embrace the ideas of Moore, which enable him to push back economic values and therefore the rationality principle. As I quoted, he said, "The attribution of rationality to human nature, instead of enriching it, now seems to me to have impoverished it. It ignored certain powerful and valuable springs of feeling." So, Keynes will draw from Moore the idea that we live in a largely non-probabilistic world. Therefore, he thinks that we must reason in radical uncertainty. But, as it is necessary to act, we must find a new basis from which it becomes possible to take decisions. These decisions must be established, according to Keynes, from expectations allowing to determine a conventional behavior, leading to situations where rumor, fear, disillusion, or, on the contrary, hope, can involve a brutal and sudden revision of these expectations. However, because ecological matters become an increasingly important component of expectations, we should adopt a more careful attitude by promoting a necessary precautionary principle, whose definition can be found in the, for instance, in the Rio Declaration on Environment and Development. What does this principle say? It says, "In order to protect the environment, the precautionary approach shall be widely applied by states according to their capabilities. Where there are threats of serious or irreversible damage, lack of full scientific certainty shall not be used as a reason for postponing cost-effective measures to prevent environmental degradation." This principle gave place to two antagonistic conceptions. The first one is connected to a weak precautionary principle that is based on a cost-benefit analysis expressing risk management. In that case, the burden of proof of the danger falls onto the opponents of the decision. Thus, this approach recognizes the primacy of economic values because it is easier to highlight economic benefits than human and ecological costs. The second one, which relies on a strong precautionary principle, considers that the promoters of a potentially dangerous decision have to show the absence of serious risk. Thus, this approach states that environmental issues, and one could add social ones, prevail over economic questions. Therefore, strong precautionary principle is not in opposition with Keynes' primacy of investment if we question the contents of such investment. That is to say, if we emphasize the role of the state that must urge firms to engage in clean investments and promote a code of ethics. In the final chapter of his general theory, Keynes thinks that the outstanding fault of the economic society in which we live are its failure to provide for full employment and its arbitrary and inequitable distribution of wealth and incomes. More than 70 years later, this assertion is still relevant. Indeed, mass unemployment, underemployment, and increasing precariousness are common either in developed or developing countries and are assimilated to a collateral damage of globalization. Keynes, whose economic analysis focuses on demand, cannot accept this situation. Indeed, an increasing instability as regards as employment contributes to create a morose economic environment, resulting in a negative impact on effective demand and thus increasing unemployment. He considers also that technological unemployment, which is, as he said, which is due to our discovery of means of economizing the use of labor, outrunning the pace at which we can find new uses for labor, may result in reducing the sorrow of each one, that is to say, to make that what work there is still to be done to be as widely shared as possible. This point of view is endorsed by the supporters of a strong sustainability. Concerning distribution, Keynes condemns the love of money as a possession, which generates speculation and therefore an increasing economic instability and more inequality. If Keynes's solution concerning unemployment and distribution of wealth are marked with sustainability, his vision of what is economics makes him a precursor of a socially sustainable development. In this respect, he considers in his Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren, 1930, that the role of economics is to allow the satisfaction of essential needs. And in his opinion, once these needs are satisfied, humanity will be able to turn to non-economic activities that will be much more important. We can wonder why, in a world producing so much wealth, the essential needs are still not satisfied. The evolution of capitalism in the last decades leads us to believe, following the example of the partisan of strong sustainability, that the power is confiscated by so-called powerful, who actually do not work anymore in favor of the general interest, but try to enhance their dominant position and their privileges. Keynes would certainly not agree with such radical positions. Having a high opinion of the bourgeoisie and the intelligentsia, he could not resign himself, even if he often noticed that they were acting in their own interest. Keynes believes, in fact, that solutions are national and promotes a trade regime based on mutual aid rather than on competition. Ultimately, promoting a cut in working time, rejecting an immoderate pecuniary accumulation, conflicting with speculation and favoring a balanced international trade result in minimizing the place of economics and make Keynes compatible with strong sustainability. However, we must recognize that, unlike other heterodox schools, such as ecological economics or institutional economics, for instance, the post-Keynesians face some difficulties to get involved into sustainable development. Even though Davidson and Weintraub were conscious of the coming ecological stakes when they released the Journal of Post-Keynesian Economics in 1978, they were barely supported on this matter. This could be explained by the fact that the post-Keynesians were engaged in a struggle with neoclassical economists for whom environment is not a key issue. Furthermore, the focus on growth or on demand could reveal a certain incompatibility with a sustainability approach. We shall see in a minute that it is not the case. Post-Keynesians, however, share some key features with sustainable development. Indeed, they stress intergenerational solidarity as well as the insurmountable nature of the ecological constraint, something that causes post-Keynesians to reject the principle of the substitutability of production factors and favor a complementarity in phase with a reasonable management of the natural resources. Post-Keynesians also attach a great importance to the concepts of hysteresis and irreversibility. Combined with radical uncertainty, which prefigures the precautionary principle, these concepts provide the foundation of an ecological approach to sustainability. Moreover, the emphasis laid on distribution and equity confirmed that post-Keynesians joined social sustainability. They follow Keynes's rejection of the positive normative distinction, which implies a primacy of politics on economics. For post-Keynesians, any action undertaken today have effects tomorrow, not only on people, but also on the biosphere. They therefore consider that simple cost-benefit analysis is fundamentally inoperative in this area. In a world marked by uncertainty, calculating on the basis of future generations' preferences is an absurdity, undermining the accuracy of any actualization effort.
Briefly ask and apologise in the few minutes I'm left. Are there specific post-Keynesian authors you have in mind in that list?
There are some few of them. Andrew Meerman, who is in Bristol, I think. Rick Holt, the American economist.
Stephen Pressman
as well. Yeah, these are the names that come in mind. What about the role of economic growth? Post-Keynesian economists, like partisans of eco-development or strong sustainability, consider that growth is a necessary but insufficient condition for development. However, to ensure that growth doesn't lead to wrong development, two questions require answering. The first one, what should grow? And the second one, how to ensure that the wealth produced benefits the whole population fairly? Economic growth does not appear to be, as neoclassical thinkers would have it, the solution to all problems. Nor is it the cause thereof, as the partisans of degrowth would have us believe. For partisans of strong sustainability, it is seen as a way of satisfying essential material and immaterial needs without damaging the environment. Thus, the question of the distribution of wealth cannot be dissociated from that of growth. Kaletsky's growth theory can be mobilized in this framework. Although the construct was developed under the aegis of socialist economy, Kaletsky has recognized in a text published in 1970 that it can also be applied in capitalist economies, as long as certain coefficients are interpreted differently. This theory is based on the following equation, the first one you can see on the slide, where R is a growth rate, I the share of investment in the national income, K is the coefficient of capital, A is the capital depreciation coefficient, which can be assimilated with economic obsolescence, and U the coefficient for a better utilization of the productive apparatus, notably, in Kaletsky's word, due to improvement in the organization of labor, more economical use of raw materials, elimination of faulty products, etc. In a capitalist economy, competition leads to a higher A and to an acceleration in Schumpeterian creative destruction, something that the post-Keynesian circuit school, like Marx, views at the origin of the crisis in the capitalist system. U depends on effective demand and can be given a negative value in case pessimistic expectations cause an underutilization of the productive apparatus. Thus, it seems that an acceleration in A hinders growth but has a negative impact on the environment by intensifying pressure on natural resources, largely due to competition effect. What remains unknown is the impact that the search for technological progress has on growth, since there is a high probability that this will diminish K and potentially increase I. Greater instability, notably relating to employment, helps to create a morose economic environment that weakens the level of effective demand. This instability, resulting from growing uncertainty, causes a fall in U that is damaging to growth. Conversely, according to Keynesian precepts, an optimistic vision of the future will lead to favorable expectations that generate, in turn, increased investment, thus higher U and lower unemployment, all of which encourages growth. It remains that higher U can also damage the environment, depending on the kind of investment chosen. For Kaletsky, who differ from Keynes on this point, it is indispensable that the state has a say both in orienting investment and in ensuring that, wherever possible, labor-intensive production techniques be used to encourage employment. Kaletsky uses a second equation that helps him to approximate the growth rate. In this second equation, the alpha coefficient is the rate of increase of labor productivity, which depends from technological progress, and epsilon, the employment growth rate. Contrary to what neoclassical economists believe, Kaletsky showed that employment encourages growth and not the other way around. The point here is not to refuse technological progress, but to turn it into a tool that helps to satisfy essential human needs while protecting the environment, an outcome that will require greater control over the substance of alpha. In sum, it would appear that regardless of the trajectory being followed, higher labor productivity can be conducive to growth, but also to higher living standards. Toward this end, it is imperative that any productivity gains be distributed fairly, demonstrating that growth and distribution cannot be dissociated. For this to occur, however, state intervention would appear to be indispensable, both to set limits and to establish a long-term vision that will help to reduce general uncertainty. The principle of effective demand is one of the main features of the post-Keynesian school. It highlights the fact that modern capitalist economies are marked by the coexistence of an underemployed workforce and excessive production capacities. By excluding any notion of scarcity, Keynes and the post-Keynesians in this wake consider that both short and long-term demand should be highlighted. An approach of this kind would appear to contradict sustainable development, since by refusing to distinguish between physical and natural capital, it intimates that the latter is also overabundant insofar as it has not been used in its entirety. In the same way, Keynes considers that full employment goes through an increase in public expenditure in order to favor investment, whatever those investments are, while Sachs, Ignacy and not Jeffrey, intends to give a Kaletskian orientation to the principle of effective demand. Indeed, unlike Keynes, Kaletsky, as I already mentioned, considers it indispensable that the state intervene in investment choices to ensure that they are geared toward the satisfaction of essential needs and the reduction of waste. This vision of things also indicates the need to revisit a logic that, as demonstrated so wonderfully by CAP, envisions firms wherever possible as entities that internalize profits and externalize social costs and therefore pillage natural resources on a regular basis. Thus, Keynes underestimates the power of vested interest, while Kaletsky underlined that the influence of economic ideas in shaping policy is severely constrained by the prevailing social and political institutions. Consequently, Kaletsky seems closer to reality when he emphasizes on political and class struggles. Moreover, Kaletsky has noted that in the case of developing economies, demand is not the only constraint that needs to be regulated. The main problem in these countries is that productive capacities are insufficient, not that they are underused. Here, we find again the idea, first developed by Kaletsky and later supported by Sachs, that growth will not be the enemy of development as long as it is accompanied by a redistribution of wealth favorable to the least advantaged social classes and also by a prudent management of natural resources. Few words of conclusion. We must acknowledge that the unified post-Keynesian approach doesn't exist yet that deals with a global approach of sustainable development, even if we can find some insights of such an analysis. However, I hope to have shown that post-Keynesianism is compatible with strong sustainability. The interlinkage between social and ecological dimensions of sustainable development requires more or less radical institutional change to ensure greater fairness, whether on an intra- or intergenerational basis. Indeed, we should keep in mind that social goals, that is to say satisfaction of basic needs, reducing poverty and inequality, etc., always come first. The political sphere, which is supposed to represent the collective project of a society, fixes the social objectives and guarantees the economic means to reach those objectives while respecting the ecological constraint. Along these lines, an analytical grid highlighting power relationships would be very useful and help to highlight the institutional obstacles that must be overcome insofar as the application of new ideas is far too often constrained by the fact that they may not serve the interest of those who have the power to change things, as Keynes mentioned it in the final chapter of his general theory. It remains that the challenges inherent to building a sustainable political economy are unquestionably worth the effort. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Eric. One of the advantages of this recording system is that when you can, I can listen to it again later to make sure I've got... Well, there's a lot of new ideas for me in there, which is very interesting. Let me move over to Adrian and invite him to talk to us for 15 or 20 minutes.
Yeah, I'll try not to speak for all that long because I'm sure lots of other people want to say things.
And it's important, I think, to try and make some space for the rest of you.
Exactly. What I will try to do is really, I enjoyed Eric's work, the papers I've just read and what he has just said. And what I want to do essentially is to provide a bit of a gloss on some of the points, maybe at some points to slightly disagree or put a slightly different sort of emphasis. And a lot of points I make will be fairly specific, but as I go through, I want to try to develop a fairly central point of argument, which I think is implicit in some of what Eric says, but I think I want to draw out more, and it relates particularly to some of the work which I've done, and I've posted a paper there as well. Now, first of all, this weak versus strong sustainability. Let's just say a little bit about that. One of the things I'm interested in is that the weak sustainability argument basically is an argument about the aggregation of capital stocks. It's about physical capital, natural capital, social capital, and all the rest of it, and attempts to aggregate these together. And I think one of the things we ought to be looking at, given the kind of people we are here, is that the old Cambridge controversies, looking across at Jeff, seem to me very relevant to a lot of this stuff. If we had difficulty aggregating just physical capitals, goodness knows what difficulties we've got aggregating across this much more heterogeneous range. So I think that's something which we'll to look at. On the strong sustainability arguments, one of the difficulties I have with those is that it's much more difficult, I think, to find a clear definition of exactly what it is. I think the weak sustainability thing is quite clearly and well defined. The strong sustainability arguments, I think, bring together quite a number of heterogeneous sort of elements into the discussion. The origins of it, and it's still presented this way in some of the textbooks, is that it, in effect, just simply put an extra side constraint on the weak sustainability condition. It basically said that we can't let the natural capital stock or some disaggregated elements in it fall below certain amounts. It essentially was an extra side condition, which is a fairly clear sort of idea, but I think people fairly quickly realised, in fact, it's not a side condition, it's actually incompatible with the weak sustainability argument. It's actually a different condition. But having said that, it shares some common core features if we focus on the capital stock issue, which is that nearly all the weak sustainability arguments, when they talk about the natural capital stock, still use some levels of aggregation in those stocks. Some go down to very disaggregated lists, but others mostly work with quite aggregated versions still. And I want to come back to that issue about this focus on the conservation of some capital stock aggregates as the comments which I make and progress. Now, the central feature of what Eric has argued, I think, is that there are certain positions in Keynes and post-Keynes economics which are consistent with the strong sustainability argument, and in fact they kind of mutually reinforce each other. And I think there's a lot of strength in that argument, although I think there are some points where the links are more difficult to establish, particularly over the role of effective demand, which you discussed a bit towards the end. In particular, there are a couple of features that Eric has drawn attention to, which are very significant. One is obviously this stuff about uncertainty and the precautionary argument. I'll just make one point about that. I think that is quite correct, that the uncertainty, as opposed to conventional distributions of risk, points you to very different sorts of ways of viewing environmental issues. But in some of the slightly more conventional literature, if you like, we've recently, people like Martin Wietzman, have been using this so-called fat-tail argument, the idea that you can use a probability distribution where the possibility of catastrophic outcomes doesn't disappear away to naught, but remains significant. And if you use a probability distribution like that, you get to the precautionary principle out of that. So in other words, there are kind of some staging points between simply conventional kind of the kind of conventional bell type of distributions and the radical Knight-Keynes uncertainty arguments. There are ways of thinking about probability distributions which put you somewhere in between those and get you to some of the same sorts of positions.
Do you sympathise with that, or is it all smoke and mirrors?
Well, I think the issue is that the reason why people have begun to use those kind of fat tail arguments is because they can actually deploy some of the stuff they're okay with. They can use some conventional probability type reasoning and all the rest of it. The only point I'm making is that the precautionary principle argument is a very difficult one to defend using any kind of conventional probability distributions. You wind up with this extreme risk aversion if you don't cross the road type of position. And
as you get older, your tail gets
fatter. And the way we've always tried to address it is to go to a radical uncertainty argument. What I'm saying is there might be ways of setting up probability distributions which would get you to a rather similar position. And I think it's just worth making that point because it is a response which a post-Keynesian might get back from a person like Martin Wietzman, for example. A second sort of issue which I think Eric has drawn attention to, which is very important, well, it's really two quite closely related things. One is, in Keynes, the emphasis on non-economic spheres and motivations and the emphasis on meeting essential needs and the wastefulness in certain sorts of social behaviour. I will just throw a couple of names in there from the 50s who I think are worth going back to look at, who I think say some very interesting things about those. One is Paul Baran in that great book, The Political Economy of Growth, where he very much tries to draw a distinction between the surplus and the non-surplus in terms of what is essential. And it's got a lot of flack from the Marxists because it's very much a moral kind of position almost that he adopts there. But I think it's one that is quite closely aligned with some of what we just heard. The other person I think who's worth mentioning, and I think we're slightly, we're people here who I won't think will blush when I say this. The other person I think is worth looking at is Che Guevara. Che Guevara, when in the 50s, when he was governor of a central bank in Cuba and minister of industry, wrote some extremely interesting stuff about moral incentives, non-economically motivated behaviour and so on and so on. And I think a lot of this has now been translated into English, and I think it is worth having a look at some of that. I think it opens up various perspectives which are of interest.
Sorry, what's the title?
The Che Guevara stuff, he wrote quite a lot of stuff. A lot of it was collected together with some of the responses in I think it's called something like Man Under Socialism or something. But the most interesting thing, which has not appeared yet fully in English, is a commentary which he wrote on the Soviet political economy stuff, criticised a lot of the conventional, economically motivated central plan stuff. And in fact, Kaletsky went to Cuba at the beginning and had a very bad time there, essentially. He didn't engage with very much at all. So I think that's an area which is maybe worth looking at a bit more. Now, one of the things, and this really gets me into probably the main point I want to make, is about the technical progress and innovation sorts of issues, and I want to just focus on those. Essentially, these weak and strong sustainability arguments run into all sorts of difficulties as soon as we begin to get any kind of underlying growth taking place through the labour force growth, essentially. And essentially, you only get out of those, and the strong sustainability one actually requires it for other sorts of reasons as well, by invoking some technical progress and innovation. And I think that was quite clear, particularly from the discussion of Kolecki, which we had there. I would just point out that there is a newer version of what sustainability means, which is kicking around in more mainstream economics now increasingly, and particularly it comes from the work of Philippe Omagion. And this is this notion that sustainability is basically to do with what happens to the rate of return on the capital stock as compared with the discount rate. Essentially, the argument is that if we've got environmental types of constraints, that tends to pull down the return on the capital stock. Technical progress tends to drive up the return on the capital stock. And sustainability is really what happens to that relationship. And Agion has tried to show that certain types of innovation have a potential to always outrun the constraints from environmental stuff. So that is a view which is beginning to get around in the literature quite a lot. And in fact, it's one that lies behind a lot of what Nick Stern does, for example, in the review which he wrote. Okay, now...
Review of what?
It was the climate change review that he did for the Treasury, which is very bad. It's full of mistakes.
Das Gupta liked it.
No, he didn't. No, quite the opposite. No. But nonetheless, it is this sort of view about relationship between rates return on the capital stock and the discount rate is one that is very much around in a lot of the literature. Now, though there's all kind of weaknesses in it, I think it's very important because it does pinpoint the key role that innovation and technical progress play in the sustainability arguments. Now, that points me towards the general argument, in a way, I want to make, and I'm now going to work back in a slightly odd way towards Keynes again. This is that whether we think of the weak sustainability or the strong sustainability arguments, the core of both of them, there are lots of add-ons in the strong sustainability argument, but the core of both of them in different ways is about maintaining, conserving some capital stock at a bigger or lower degree of aggregation. So I think the word conserving is important. Now, rather conservative sorts of views. And I think as post-Keynesians, we should be thinking about much more open-ended positions where we've got possibilities for learning and innovation and all the rest of it. And I think the idea that we need to focus much more on how does innovation take place and how does innovation help with resolving sustainability issues under different social structures is a focus which I think is a much more interesting one. And here I can pick up on a couple of points, one which Eric made, which is that one of the key features of all environmental issues is irreversibilities. That we have situations always where if we deplete a natural resource or if we cause damage to the atmosphere or whatever it is, there's an irreversibility in there. And as Eric correctly said, that's very close related to a lot of post-Keynesian issues. The other feature, and the one I've just suggested, is that if partly at least some of the way we think about what is a social solution to the sustainability issue is to focus on innovation, and innovation is about how we learn, that we acquire new information, we try to resolve uncertainties, and so on. If you put irreversibilities and the learning, acquiring information together, there's a very well known bit of environmental economics which is called a quasi-option, which does it exactly those things, which was first developed by Arrow and others. And I think you can argue that a lot of sustainability issues can be thought of as like a big problem in quasi-options. It's about what happens in situations where you're going to do something irreversible, but you don't that you have to kind of wait and learn to acquire the information that you actually need to think, how can I innovate to resolve those? Now, there's an interesting bit of literature around about 20 years ago where some people began to think of liquidity preference as basically a quasi-option idea. If you think of the way that Shackle, for example, discusses it, where we avoid locking ourselves into certain decisions, and liquidity preference is a way of avoiding that locking into decisions while we try to get more information about what is happening. And as I say, there's a small but interesting literature which models that as a quasi-option, that liquidity preference decision. I'd sooner flip that around, because I think that quasi-options and closely related, these newer things called real options, actually use a lot of fairly conventional kind of economic modelling to deal with. And in fact, some of the modelling is not a million miles away from some of the stuff that brought financial institutions to disaster, not to the brink of it. I think it's much interesting to actually think of it as liquidity preference itself, which I think is a more general, all-encompassing sort of notion. And I think a lot of sustainability issues you can actually think about as a kind of liquidity preference issue, where often what we're doing is trying to make a decision in the face of uncertainties and irreversibilities, and there is a case for delaying decisions or for incurring costs to give us some more flexibility in our decisions while we wait to find out what is actually happening to the environment, what the longer run technical solutions in inverted commas might begin to look like. So I think a much more interesting way, rather than thinking of weak and strong sustainability and conservation of capital stocks, is to think of sustainability as a process about learning about what options are open to us and how the future is going to evolve, and how we then make decisions about when do we actually opt to, say, go into certain renewable energy technologies, or do we try to hold a lot of energy technologies open and with the possibility of switching between one and the other at a later date when things begin to emerge in a clear-cut way. So I would go for a view of sustainability as a little post-Keynesian slogan in a way, and I would like to say we should view sustainability as a big problem of liquidity preference, essentially, not as a rather, and this even applies to the strong sustainability, of a rather neoclassical notion of how do we conserve the value of capital stocks.